Brandon, would you like to start us off?
Okay. It's probably very appropriate that RATS has hosted a session on anarchism because RATS has always been pretty much an anarchistic organization. There has never been any institutionalized structure to it. There is no, it is not held annually. It is only held when some group of people wish to call it. And it has existed now since 1982. And I couldn't really tell you how many times since 1982 it's been held, but it's maybe half those years. So there's a sense in which it's very appropriate, I think, that that this topic has been taken on. I've been listening to the papers, and my remarks are really not so much in reaction to the individual papers, but to talk about broad issues that have been raised. And I do that not from an anarchistic perspective, but from a Marxist one. That is the political space, theoretical and philosophical space that I've built my work and thinking around. And I think one of the things that we need to recognize and be highly aware of, and something that I don't feel has happened here, but something I think we have to constantly be wary of, is one of the problems with the left is it tends to eat its own young. There's a tendency to be hypercritical among ourselves. And so I think whenever we get together to talk about things, it's important to recognize that we, in fact, I think most of the people here, most of the papers I've heard, or all the papers I've heard, probably share several assumptions. And please, if you feel I have misrepresented something you said, or that you wouldn't share those assumptions, you should say so. But first is that we live in a world that is deeply flawed, problematic, and oppressive. That there are relations in this world that are oppressive of people and that favor the few over the many. I think probably most of us, probably more than most of us, would root those or find those in some way in capitalism. I think it's important that we recognize that these are assumptions that the vast majority of our colleagues do not share in our theology. The vast majority of our colleagues do not see this the world as being that way. The other thing that we hold, or I think most of us would agree to, is that capitalism is not inevitable, natural, or given. That despite the fact that capitalism doesn't do anything, but the capitalists are constantly telling us that it is all three of those things, inevitable, natural, and given, that it is not. And this is probably one of the most powerful things our theology can do, is to show that, in fact, for most of the world's history, there wasn't such thing. That the social relations that are taken as given in today did not exist for all world's history. A final thing that we all I don't want to say all, but again, I think most of us would agree on, is that knowledge is politically situated. That knowledge, certainly beyond the trivial, I mean, there are trivial things. You know, this chair is black. Okay? We probably all agree on that. We can call that a fact. But beyond kind of trivial observations, certainly once we try to make any kind of social sense of any kind of observation, that knowledge is politically situated. And that thus, archaeology is a political exercise and involved in engaging in politics when we do it, in all senses, in the sense of, and we've seen this illustrated in a number of the presentations, in the sense of how it relates to the world, to the people we're talking about. I can call it a presentation, the fact that marine archaeology has almost always brought a particular view of the world and way of dealing with the world that is not necessarily, and Miles' paper addressed this too, it's not necessarily the view, and very often is oppositional or oppressive of the view of the people that we are actually studying. Political in the sense that what we say about the past implies certain assumptions, certain ideologies about what the present is or what the present can be. And political in the sense, and this is something else I think that came out, not so much in the sense of structural archaeology per se, but in terms of the structure of the academy, theology, and these kinds of things, Political in the sense that the doing of archaeology and relations within and between archaeologists and what we do. I would submit to you that all these things are not things that a majority of archaeologists in the United States believe or would agree with. So I think what, as we kind of use these kinds of occasions to kind of sharpen our knives, I think that's what we need to do, but I think we should not be sharpening them to use on each other. I think we should be sharpening to use on people who do not agree with these kinds of basic statements I've made, and perhaps a larger list could be assembled. Another thing I think we need to recognize is that when we're talking about ideas like anarchy or like Marxism came up often. It didn't surprise me. Marxism is kind of always seems to be the counterweight, the opposition to anarchy, and there's good reasons for that. Because they both share this idea of transforming the world, but don't necessarily agree on how to do it. I think we should recognize we're talking about old philosophies here. We're talking about ideas that are over 100 years old, that arguably had their peak before most of us were born, and that have failed. And I say that as someone who has very publicly advocated a Marxist stance. I'm not targeting somebody else here, I'm targeting myself. And it failed. They failed for a couple of reasons. I would submit that the primary reason they failed is because capitalism and all the things that go along with that are far, far more powerful than the founding figures of the philosophies we're discussing here today ever imagined. And I think that's something that I found a little lacking in a lot of the presentations, is the incredible power of what we are confronting. And then also, Marxism or anarchism as alternatives have failed. Anarchism, with the brief exception of, I wouldn't even argue all of Spain, but of Barcelona, to my knowledge, and I may just be ignorant on this, but to the best of my knowledge, only came to power as a political movement, only held power as a political movement in that one time. And it did not last, and I'll return to that in a minute. Marxism has failed in more profound and disturbing ways, as was alluded to, in the sense that it has in many cases, and certainly in the most prominent cases, certainly in the most kind of politically successful cases, turned into something that is oppressive, totalitarian, and totally contrary to everything we've been hearing here today. Anarchism has failed because, I think the problem with anarchism is that we should not underestimate the opposition, the power of what we're confronting. One thing we need to realize, and I don't think a lot of people do, but if we look at the history of the world from the 20th century till now, every successful political attempt to transform a state governmental structure to a socialist state, to a true socialist state, has been actively, militarily, and violently opposed by the capitalist nations. Most Americans are unaware of the fact that the United States, France, and Britain invaded Russia, actively supported the white counter-revolution during the revolution. More recently, the democratically elected governments in Nicaragua were militarily opposed by the United States through puppet forces. The Allende government in Chile was overturned by a coup that not even the CIA now bothers to deny that it was behind. And Allende, who was the legally elected president of Chile, was killed. And as were thousands of other people in the days that followed the coup. There is not a single instance where a socialist revolution, or even a democratic transition, has not been actively opposed. And anarchism has proven particularly unable to resist that opposition, and again, the case of Barcelona comes to play. But of course, what did in anarchism in Barcelona were the Soviets. So, and that leads to the problem with Marxism, which is that Marxism has, Marxist approaches have successfully maintained the state in opposition, maintained the socialist reality in opposition to this, but they've done so almost always by sliding into totalitarianism. So that, for my mind, anarchism, if we're going to talk about me as a Marxist thinking about these things, is a very important counterbalance. There's a tension, because anarchism, if anything, cannot be told totalitarian, given its basic structure and everything. I can't imagine how you can claim to be a totalitarian anarchist. We might argue that you can't claim to be a totalitarian Marxist, but obviously so many people have done so, I'm really at a disadvantage trying to argue that. And I think, though, we need to, in part, focus not so much on the kind of internal factors that allow, say, a Marxist approach to become that, because that then leads to totalitarianism, or the ones within anarchism that doesn't allow it to do it, because I think that has led us to the position where we cannot see a successful anarchistic revolution. But we need to look at the tension between these things and look at the counterbalance of them. So for me, in my own thought, I see anarchism and its ideas as a weight, as a tension, as something that I need to throw on so that those aspects of my own thought that might lead in these roads, I can perhaps do better. Of course, my Marxist colleagues and critiques of my work consistently critique me as being guilty of idealism and pluralism, but that's another discussion. That said, the last thing I want to address is the issue of something that came up it's numerous times in this discussion. This is to speak more now as an anthropologist. And came up very obviously when we were talking about these ideas these ideas of anti-civilization, anarchism, and primitivism, but also even came up in some of the things that, like Mark was saying. I think we have to be really careful. I think those of you, there are a few people in the room who are apparently not anthropologists and archaeologists. I think you should realize that the idea of the primitive is utterly and totally discredited within anthropology. The idea that there are primitive people in the world, or that there have been primitive people in the world for less than maybe 10,000 years ago, the primitives did exist. But in terms of the modern ethnographic knowledge of the world, the idea that some of these people are somehow primitive, somehow closer to nature than the rest of us, and somehow closer to the true human condition than the rest of us, is simply bullshit. All right? Every modern group is the product of the same history and long history as we are. The Gung are the Gung because they used to be farmers and herders in the Cape. The Dutch moved into the Cape, the Bantu moved down south, the Gung got squeezed out and they end up in the Kalahari. And then they become in the 1960s, the prototypical primitive society. So all of these groups have histories and all of that. Also, I think we have to realize that we have to, I think, be very careful of, and I'm kind of picking up on a lot of this coming from some of what people are talking about in the anarchism, of a kind of romanticized primitivism. It is true that the Gong do not have a police. It's also true if you look at studies done in the early 1980s, I don't have the citations, but if you're interested in emailing, I can get them for you. Someone did a study of violence in Gong society. And basically what they figured out is, and if you took the rate, the number of people who were murdered, and then you calculated it on a per thousand basis and compared it to American crime statistics, your likelihood of being murdered as a Gong were about double that of any American city. So I think we have to be very, very careful when we talk about this. These people are neither, Hobbesians, life of the primitive is nasty, brutish, and short, nor are they Rousseauian natural, Rousseauian noble savages. I would warn that is all something that needs to be looked at. And by the same token, I think we have to be careful of the idea that somehow egalitarian relations are the null set. That somehow if societies are small enough and primitive enough, they will be egalitarian. Because the truth is, and Bruce Trigger, I think, is the person who's pointed this out unfortunately, The egalitarian societies maintain themselves as egalitarian through a great amount of effort. It doesn't just happen. You know, the kind of problems we have of building a socialist state, or building an anarchist state where people have equality and can be developed to their full potential, are not simply problems that have been created by civilization, they're fundamental problems of human society and culture. And so instead of looking at these societies as somehow being this primitive set, this thing we should go back to, we should be asking questions about how have they accomplished that, and looking at the ways that they do that. So anyway, that's fine.
I think I'll just take this spot and go ahead, because I've made, over the course of this conference, this little map that I created, this little book, and it's getting increasingly full, so in order to prevent me from getting confused by my own thoughts, I just will start talking about some of these issues that I've put it down. I've basically broken this up in two parts. I'm going to talk about some rather disconnected thoughts. And then on one of Paulette's slides, there was this quote that described anarchism, and it says, in the end, some of us like olives, some of us don't. So I picked out some olives that I would like to talk about. Some of those are issues that I tackle myself in my dissertation, and there's some questions I have, and some maybe prospects you could think about for the future when we talk about a better world, not necessarily a more democratic world, because I have my issues with the word democratic, but yeah, a more equal, just society. I think what has become clear from the papers that we've heard today is that archaeology can be, is many times, I would say, is an exclusionary political project. Paulette has talked about this in her paper. And some people have argued for making archaeology a more inclusionary project. And I think that's a very important thing. Nias has mentioned this in his paper. And I think when you talk about the notion of primitivist society, primitivism or primitive versus modern societies, I think that is also, as Randy has cautioned, something dangerous to do, because we create a distinction between modern primitive, as we like to do when some people have talked about Homo erectus versus Homo sapiens. We also like to do this with human-animal distinction. We make distinctions between who is human, who is not yet human. Like, there are these graduations and categories of people that get created and that lead to exclusion and real experienced discrimination against people. Another issue that just came in my head is Randy talked was the issue of violence and conflict, and I had to also think back about David Graeber's book when he talks about that sometimes people think that an anarchist society or a society that is peaceful, that there is no conflict, that there is no violence. And I think that's an illusion. There is conflict always, not necessarily violence in the worst case scenarios that we can imagine, but it depends on where this violence takes place and where the conflict takes place. And in societies, in certain societies, that conflict and violence is pushed into, for example, metaphysical realms or like mythical spheres, things like that. So that's something to, I think, keep in mind. Also, when you talk about ritual practices like burning and things like this. In general, I hope that, you know, with the papers we've seen, we can talk about, on the one hand, how anarchist theory can contribute to archaeological studies, which I think is really interesting and helpful. And I've actually worked at Göbekli Tepe, the last example that we've heard about, and I think that is one perfect example of how anarchist ideas can be applied to an archaeological site to interpret this. Because the person who has excavated the site talks about the site as a ritual site, and he talks about terrors for a society that is still, to a large degree, mobile. And the notion of temples brings with it all kinds of problems, not the least the public-private distinction, for example. And on the other hand, I think we can also learn from archaeology and contribute to archaeological theories, especially when we talk about primitivist anarchist theories and the like. So those were these somewhat disconnected thoughts I have. The mind map I've created has a number of issues, and I try to connect them as good as I can. And I try to also, again, refer to papers where those issues were brought up to some extent. I've created four big themes, so to say. One is imagination. Another one is contradiction. Another one is community, and the last one I've thought of is resistance. And I think that, and I've said this in other contexts too, that often as archaeologists or anthropologists or academics, we lack imagination, and not just any imagination, but political imagination, because we are very good in imagining past societies, but we often do this, again, modeling those past societies just after how we experience our world today. And I think we need to think about new ways of imagining politics and allowing for new ways of political imagination that allows for contradiction. And I was thinking, especially when Mark talked about this notion of skill and how skill is something that seems to be embodied, we grow into this. We develop skills and we grow up with that, and we are very much trained and used to working in a certain context and using the skills that we have. And sometimes there's this notion that skill is something that is tacit knowledge, that you cannot really talk about it. You just do things, you show other people how you do things, but there's no level of really criticizing what you're doing. So I'm thinking that there would be two issues to create a skill for all of us that would make it possible to transform the skill in such a way that we can live in a different kind of society. And that would mean to make the skill somewhat explicit, to be able to talk about it and make it criticizable, which could be some kind of tacit criticism, if you want. So if that knowledge is really tacit and something we cannot readily draw on and make it communicable so easily, we can still, on a certain level, get hold of this knowledge and use that you talked about, the linguistic ground where we can connect the non-linguistic entities. And another thing I was thinking, and that also came in my mind when your paper was had in the title the word home. And I think sometimes people today would describe the world we live in a world that you cannot feel at home anymore. And a world that is, you know, a world of unease, discomfort, it's scary. But I think what I often find when I see anarchists who I know, that there is this sense of a feeling at home in not feeling at home. And I think that is a really important thing when I see, for example, I mean, people talk about pirates, the traveler kids that you can see hitchhiking on a highway. Those are those people for me that are at home and not feeling at home. They don't have to have their living room with a TV and a case of CDs and their bedroom to sleep in at night. It's this idea that home is where the heart is. And I think when we apply this to the notion of skill, we could say we could develop a skill of habitual spontaneity, where we can constantly change our practices the whole time, be critical of what we're doing, but make this, to some extent, habitual so that we can feel at home, at this, not feeling at home. At the same time, then, when I talk about this, there are people who have theorized this, like Paolo Virno has written this book, The Grammar of the Multitude, who talks about that exact kind of skill that is very flexible and dynamic, that characterizes the post-Fordist worker, the worker that is not working in the assembly line anymore, but the worker who is doing all kinds of work, is flexible, that's what's wanted by the bosses, because that makes the post-Fordist production even more productive. And that kind of skill becomes very exploitable. So I think you have to also think about how that skill can be used by us, but does not become exploitable at the same time, if that makes sense. And I think that this, the term that Joe used of radical self-reliance may somewhat play in here, that, you know, you have to rely on yourself. But how exactly to do this, again, I'm not providing answers. Those are some questions and thoughts that you know. Another thing is that of political imagination, I want to talk a little bit more about this, and I want to talk about things that we should be afraid of. I've thought about this at some point. I guess, you know, political movements happen, or political protests happen, people get arrested. You see police on the streets, you get stopped in a car because you, whatever, forgot to turn on your lights or something, and it's each time a very uncomfortable situation, and the more I experience such situations, the more I get scared by the powers to be, you know, people, a police officer who comes up to you in your car, and I think, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm totally to the mercy of this person. And I'm afraid of those figures of power that are very easily detectable for me. But I'm not afraid when I drive here on Vestal Parkway, which is like a strip mall, at night, and everything is dark and kind of like a ghost town. And I think, well, you know, this is the mall that I can go to during the day, and that's where I do shopping, and that's where I live my life, and that's where I feel comfortable, because you know all these places, McDonald's is the same all over the world, and this is where we are trained to feel comfortable, and we are trained not to find that scary. And I think we need to think about what we are afraid of and what we're not, because I think that's the really scary places, the malls that this should be, the mall should be scared than a police officer. And I think that also allows them to talk about, I think Mark also mentioned this, that yeah, once you enter in a conversation with the police officer, there are other aspects coming out of a person, a human being. And I still refuse to, I know there are some people who say I hate cops, and I understand why, and I think there are probably more reasons to dislike police than to like police, but they are also individual people. And nothing can be readily dismissed altogether all the time. And I think we have to think about those things that can be changed and those things that, as Tom kind of brought this up, there's something, things that cannot be changed that need to be abandoned, exited, maybe left, but there are also possibilities for changing things. That's somewhat brings me to these other two terms that I brought up, community and resistance. And I would want to phrase it in a way that I say community contains resistance or space for resistance. And maybe I should clarify this word community a little bit. And like Tom, I would say it's, you know, a social community. All of these words are not perfect words. They are somewhat dissatisfying sometimes. There's community, there's the idea of the multitude, there are networks. But I work with the word community because I am using it in my dissertation. I think there are ways to qualify community in such a way that it makes sense and it contains qualities that we would like to see in the world. So when I talk about community and this idea of resistance, I think what we should acknowledge is that we don't necessarily have to deal with communities that are exclusionary, because when you talk about, again, the archaeological community, the academic community is a very exclusionary space, because you're either in or you're out. And we sometimes forget that even if you're inside that space, you kind of go through a training, a gradual training where you come in as somebody who's completely unskilled, and you will go through all different kinds of also rituals and exams and things that are very unpleasant. And then at some point you'll be skilled and qualified to be a full standing member of that community. But I think we should pay more attention to those people who enter and exit communities very frequently. And that again is something that kind of comes from my reading from the Grammar of the Multitude, because when you talk about resistance, a lot of people think about the strike, the protest, those things that the masses do, where we all have to stick together, we all have to do the same thing, we all have to kind of think the same thing in order to be successful. But that's maybe not the way the world works anymore these days. That's why we should maybe more think about that multitude, the idea that there are a lot of people with a general sense for what they want that is very similar, but there's also still individual interests that are very much diverging. And there should be space for that, and maybe that space can be provided by having smaller scale communities and having the providing the possibility for people to move in and out of these communities as they wish to do. But again, that would also require us to rethink, you know, ideas of skill, ideas of education, of skill in the broadest sense. And then again, also when we think of the notion of community, another thing, when I talk about exiting or leaving or entering a community, this is something that in German is called Handlungsraum, which means basically space of practice. That means that there's room for people not only to do things, but also not to do things. And that is something characterized as exodus or retreatism, that people can retreat from things as they, from activities as they choose to do. At the same time, not only having people leave a community, but also having people enter communities is a really important thing. And I think when we talk about archaeology, as we've done here in those many papers, we need to engage this idea of a public archaeology and of engaging people and starting dialogue with those people who are not within academia or who are within academia but do other kinds of work than we are doing. And I think some of the papers have shown that there are issues that I have not heard about before, like the archaeology of destruction that John talked about, that I think is something really important, because that concerns, that is an archaeology for me that makes sense. I work in Neolithic prehistoric times, and sometimes I wonder what sense that makes, because, I mean, I know it does, there are theories that I work on that I talk about right now, but at the same time, there is the contemporary past. There are contemporary people who are very much affected by our work directly or indirectly, and so we should think of those people and just have the community open so that people can enter that space. And that, in extension, will also have us let us think about archaeological subjects and ourselves as subjects and objects and things like that. But I'll leave it as at this.
So I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to summarize, because I don't have a clear summary, and I just don't. So